Before we start, this episode contains some chat you might find difficult to hear, so do check the show notes for more details. Hello and welcome to Happy Place, the show that encourages gorgeous human connection. Today I'm chatting to Ian Redpath and Jeremy Chopra. They're the men you might know better as TFL's All On The Board.
One of the things that we notice with those boards, there's boards all over the network, but people tend to ignore them. But then they don't ignore the things that we put on them, and I think it's because they realise that, one, it's handwritten, so it's by a person. It's a person there. And then when they take note of that, then they read it, and then they read the words that we're putting on there, which is about connecting. It's about connecting with themselves and what they're going through and what we go through and so on. And then they realise, oh, there's someone here who's written that, and they go with it. And that whole connection thing happens.
In 2017, poems and little messages of hope and support started appearing on whiteboards at London's underground tube stations. They got posted on social media and the words resonated with so many people that their Instagram account, All On The Board, now has over a million followers. A couple of years ago, Ian and Jeremy, two customer service assistants for TFL, revealed themselves as the amazing creatives behind the writing, and it was the biggest privilege to get to chat with them about their own mental health when they came round to mine at the end of last year. They've been through a lot. Between them, PTSD, social anxiety, insomnia, panic attacks, imposter syndrome. And I do think that's why their poems have touched so many people, because you can just tell they're coming from a place of real understanding and empathy.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Okay, let's do it. Here's the show. On the board.
Hello, Fern. Hello. Thank you for having us.
Thanks for having us.
Oh, Ian and Jeremy, it's so lovely to have you here. And do you know how chuffed I am that you've worn your actual uniforms?
We've done it just for you.
Just for you.
Yeah.
I'm so grateful. We're going to take an award-winning photo a bit later on.
Oh, amazing.
I'm so glad to have you here. Obviously, we met earlier on in the year at the Happy Place Festival. Although we've been sort of messaging each other for quite a long time now, actually, but you spread so much joy and happiness at the Happy Place Festival. So thank you for being there, first of all.
Oh, well, thank you. That means the world to hear that, honestly. Your kind words mean everything. And thanks for inviting us to the Happy Place Festival. We genuinely felt happy.
No, I mean, we were nervous when we arrived. We had that little poetry to read poems at, and we were like, we've never done this before. And the whole social anxiety thing started to go, and we're like, we got no time now because we're going up. Now, and we went up, and then you said something to the crowd. You told them about my social anxiety.
I did.
They were the loveliest people.
Yeah.
I don't know, you know, I don't know if they're just like that all the time, which they probably are, but also I think the vibe of that festival just made everyone just be really supportive, and they were clapping us, and they were you know, whooping us as well. And
yeah.
They were lovely.
And I've never wanted to hug anyone so badly. Mm. Literally every person that we came across just wanted to hug them, you know?
Yeah.
And like we were saying, Jeremy's got social anxiety, and then suddenly we find ourselves reading poetry out loud, first time that we've ever done it, by a tree, and just all these like lovely people around. Like,
that's such a brilliant idea, by the way.
Yeah, poetry. Amazing.
The poetry. Yeah. I can't take credit for that. It was someone on my team, Eunice, who came up with that.
Eunice,
and it was
well done.
Oh, Eunice, that's such a good idea. And it's a beautiful tree in the grounds of Chiswick Park. But you're so right. I think the lovely community that come to the festival really want to sort of learn and try new things, but also there are many people that turn up with social anxiety, and we're quite mindful of that at the festival, that we don't oversell tickets so it's super crowded. We want there to be room and space for people to walk around, and for there to be little areas, corners where people can take themselves away from the larger crowds and go, oh, I just need a minute on my own. So I think it must have felt, I'm sure, because I deal with the same thing quite often, quite relieving saying that out loud to a crowd and it being met with, yeah, I hear you, like, I see you, I get it.
Yeah, it blew my mind in that instantly. I was like, oh, wow, they're with this. They're cool about it. That's brilliant. Let's go on. And we kept on reading. And then, you know what? I think we went into the next guy's time a little bit. But he was standing there and he was enjoying it. He was like, no, you guys keep going.
Actually, you're like, we're never coming off. We're going to stay.
Yeah, it got to that point.
Do you know what? It felt a bit like karaoke towards the end. You know what I mean? You know when you've got that particular singer that doesn't want to get off and they put their name down for everything? But it was just wonderful.
Honestly,
feeling.
Thank you so much for, that was really kind of you to invite us. And we had a blast.
Well, I'm so glad to have you here as well for the podcast because you've got your new book, Your Daily Companion, which not only looks gorgeous and beautiful, colourful pages, but it's full of all of these wonderful poems and boards, but new exclusive writing that you've done for the book as well, and some more of your own personal stories that you've written about, which is so helpful. But before we get into that, let's just go right back to the start for people that don't know about your beautiful work. So your two customer service assistants working in Transport for London, and it was 2017 you started to write up these poems. And it started in the context of gigs happening around London, and you would write a poem about the person who was playing at, say, the O2 or wherever it might be. Whose idea was it? How was that idea established, and how has it evolved? Because it seems a very natural evolution from that place.
Do you know what? It was a natural evolution. It was like, sir, myself and Jeremy, people coming past for the Craig David concert, and we was kind of going through all the Craig David songs that we knew, and then we kind of started singing them badly to one another. You know, we're not Craig David, are we? Yeah, you know, 7 days walking away and stuff. And then we composed a little poem, and it was like, it was a poem kind of giving directions to the O2, there was a board in the middle of the ticket hall that just said keep right. I mean, people don't need to be told to keep right.
No.
What they need is a Craig David poem telling them how to get to the O2.
Correct.
With the song titles in.
Correct.
There. So we kind of wiped the keep right off the board, and we was a bit hesitant at first about putting on the poem, thinking, maybe we'll get in trouble for it. But, you know, I mean, why not, you know?
Why not? Thank God you did, because look what you've started. You know, this snowball effect of, you know, that one moment thinking, shall we do this, shall we not? And that one decision has changed the course of your lives completely. And you've helped so many people. And what I love about what you do is you've made travelling on the underground a happier place. You know, I think a lot of people, and you write about this in your book, don't like travelling on the trains because they're either, you know, prone to panic attacks, or it's just a stressful part of the day. They might be late, just simple things, rushing. And I think also, when I think about when I was a teenager and I grew up in the suburbs, so I was on the tube all the time coming into town. And we didn't have mobile phones then. So you would sit, you might read, but actually you might clock eyes with someone and start randomly chatting. And today we've all got these, like, we create these little cocoons of headphones, maybe sunglasses, a hood, your phone, and that connection's lost. And I think what you're doing, and I don't know if this is, you know, part of why you're doing it, is to sort of reinstate that we're all human, we're all, you know, trying to do our best and struggling on any given day, but let's just all connect on a very human level. And you've done that through the power of writing. It's beautiful.
Yeah, and no, absolutely. We, you know, one of the things that we notice with those boards, this boards all over the network, but people tend to ignore them. But then they don't ignore the things that we put on them. And I think it's because they realise that, one, it's handwritten, so it's by a person. It's a person there. And then when they take note of that, then they read it, and then they read the words that we're putting on there, which is about connecting. It's about connecting with themselves and what they're going through and what we go through and so on. And then they realise, oh, there's someone here who's written that, and they go with it. And that whole connection thing happens. We got to this one point where we were doing magic tricks on the boards. We would write down a magic trick and then say, go to a member of staff and tell them the answer, and then they will tell you something about you. And we started doing things just to get people to kind of come over and speak with staff in a different way. And we might do that again, actually.
Yeah. I'll do that again. I love that.
We had some good magic tricks. We run out of magic tricks.
Yeah.
But we had some good ones,
didn't we?
We need to call Stephen Mulhern and get a few more up your sleeve.
He's
and then
fantastic.
We can get some more for you. We'll get some more tricks. Because I think that is lovely. And I think especially when you work in any sort of customer service job, not everybody, but certain people completely dehumanise you and will let off all of their anger and aggression to you and talk to you in a very curt, blunt way. And again, you've changed that. You're like, I'm a human. Here's what I'm going through. And I'm going to connect with you through words which will resonate with what you're going through. And it just, again, it just totally, it's like a ripple effect of everyone just going, oh yeah, we're all human, we're all trying our best. It's not this person's fault that that turnstile's not working, or I don't know why that train's not on or whatever. It's just bringing like the very human level to like a very hectic part of the day, I think.
Yeah, I mean, again, with the Happy Place Festival, because it's like a community and bringing people together, and we kind of like, you know, anyone that uses the tube, like you said, everyone's in their own cocoons on the phone, like, you know, just in their own little worlds. And it was kind of like, you know, it's the busiest place, you know, it's one of the busiest places in the world. And yet it feels like the loneliest place at times.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? You're all on your separate journeys and that. And we kind of like the idea of people showing up at a station, they've all come on their separate journeys, and then they kind of gather around a board and, you know, critique it or laugh at it or take selfies with it. And then they ask one another to take photos of one another. It was kind of like bringing people together at the end of a journey and kind of making them smile. And I mean, we can't lie, we get a buzz from that, just seeing people sort of just smiling and being happy, and kind of like fuels us on to do more, you know.
And your words have resonated because you have channeled everything that you've been through personally into these poems or pieces that you're putting on the boards. It's not just about gigs these days. You do talk about all manner of things and mental health and physical health. Did you initially bond as friends over that? Did you sort of connect on a personal level of sharing your own stories?
You know what? Our manager originally put us together. She saw that we had this kind of like creativity about each of us. We hadn't worked with each other yet. And then she kind of said, you guys should work together and do stuff together. And so she put us on shifts together. And we started talking about things. We were trying to write a sitcom. We were coming up with this idea for
no
a sitcom.
No way!
Mm. Yeah, we come up with, I think, like 20 episodes.
What was it? What was the sitcom?
It.
We need to reinstate this.
We'll definitely get there, but it's definitely unique.
We can tell you afterwards.
Right, okay.
Yeah.
Don't attempt fate.
Because I think we'll do it.
Yeah.
But we were just being creative in all these kind of ways. And of course, like in the middle of that conversation, came up with the Craig David poem. And I think we were just connecting with each other creatively. I think in terms of mental health and invisible illnesses and all that, we didn't know any of that about each other at all.
Really?
Yeah, and it was, about 3 or 6 months, something like that, after we started doing those boards of the events that we took the step to kind of write something more personal. I can't remember what the first one was.
Possibly about anxiety attacks or panic attacks.
Might have been the Crohn's. One. I can't remember.
Yeah,
which one
but it's generally we kind of talk about our own conditions. You know what I mean? We don't want anyone to feel embarrassed to talk about mental health, or, you know, you shouldn't have to be brave to come out. You know what I mean? It should be just like, you know what I mean, we're all in it together and stuff. You know, and it's just kind of just to address it. You know, it's all right for boys and men to cry. It's all right for women to cry. It's all right to have a shoulder to cry and ask for help. And it's like, you know, I've had counselling, you know, throughout my life for various things and that, and we just kind of want to get in there, you know, just to, you know, smash the stigma and sort of break all the taboos and stuff. And yeah, we try our very best, you know. And conditions that, like, I remember we wrote about endometriosis, and like we did research on it, and like how it came about. It's like my wife used to get really bad period pains, and it just like chronic really bad pains, and it, like we kind of looked into it and sort of discovered this condition called endometriosis. And it was like, can't believe that people go through this, and we kind of wanted to address it on the board. And for, despite looking like we're in our mid-20s, we're in our 40s, yeah?
No.
Same. And then it just seems bonkers for two guys in their 40s to be writing about endometriosis on a board, but we kind of, just wanted to do it anyway, you know, and it kind of went down well.
Well, it connects with people, and also it might have been a moment of discovery for someone who's not looked into that.
I thought, bloody hell, I might
you know, take a chance and look into it, or go and seek professional help.
And I think that's what it was. It's just like, we wanted to kind of like, you know, make the invisible visible. You know, there's so many invisible illnesses and sort of like, you know, disabilities that can't be seen. And like, you know, sometimes when people like use a tube, you know, someone will look at a youngster sitting down on the seat, not wanting to give up their seat for another person, but who knows what they're going through? You know? Because I've got ulcerative colitis. Sometimes I get such bad fatigue that, you know, as much as I want to stand up for someone, I just physically can't. And just every step feels like a mile, you know? And so it's just a sort of...
But obviously, like, if people communicated on the tube, for example, that whole stigma wouldn't exist, because that person sitting there, if they felt comfortable to say it and you felt comfortable to ask and so on and so forth, that wouldn't even be a problem. So, you know, maybe we're trying to bridge still that kind of get people talking more, you know, get people to recognise the potential there to talk and so on and so forth. It's still going to be a bit of a trick for a lot of people, but you know.
And do you know what? Yeah. And round about that time that we was writing, we don't know whether we influenced it or it was kind of like a perfect storm where people were thinking the same thing, but there started to be like appearing on sort of train seats, like not all disabilities are visible on seats, like for the priority seats. And it was kind of like, seemed to happen at the same kind of time. So
yeah. Well, I think, you know, one thing, obviously, and we've touched on it very lightly, obviously it's prevalent for people to experience anxiety attacks or panic attacks when they're in the underground on the tube, because it might be due to claustrophobia or the amount of people that are there, or it just triggers something in them. And obviously, they manifest in very different ways. For some people, it would be very obvious they were having a panic attack. When I'm having one, nobody knows. It is completely internalised. My heart is racing, but no one can see it. My breathing is relatively normal. I can sort of control that bit, but the cognitive element is off the scale. My heart's racing. I'm hot. I feel like I'm going to faint. But if you were looking at me, it's like I'm sat here now. So I think, again, looking into that and the amount of people that are triggered by going on the underground. And like you said, you have to comfort people on a regular basis who are dealing with that. How do you approach that? Because obviously that is something that takes a lot of care and understanding and empathy to deal with. And you're not doctors, you're not medical professionals, but you are able to ease people's nerves and to help people in that way.
I think it helps that kind of we know that it's not life threatening.
Yeah.
So when you approach somebody and you just start talking to them about what they're going through, you know that you don't necessarily have to be a doctor or something like that. You just have to be there for them and just talk to them as long as you can, and time will do the rest, you know. Just get them away from the situation and it works out. A number of times we've had people like 20, 30,000 people coming through in one go. And yeah, there's all this vibe and everyone's loving it and all that, but not everyone does. They'd have a panic attack in the corner and no one notices, but we've noticed them, gone over, helped. And, you know, 10, 15 minutes later, their eyes rain, they can go on, you know, and they're happy to do that. And that's part of our job, to be quite honest with you. It's part of our job to help people in that way. But yeah, not everyone can do it. Not everyone's going to go and do it either. You know, a lot of the time people are having panic attacks and they just have to figure it out for themselves, which is pretty sad, to be honest. It's nice to be able to do that.
Well, lovely feeling for you guys too, to know that you've genuinely impacted someone's day or evening in such an important way. And there's an amazing story in the book, Ian, where you help a little girl who was terrified of getting on the escalators. Would you mind sharing a bit of that story with us?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, like, I've been working for the underground for like 21 years now, and it still remains one of my favourite memories of the job. And what it was, I was working at Warren Street tube station, and then I noticed at the top of the escalator there was a man, a woman, and a little girl, and she was kind of just not wanting to get on that escalator. And I kind of went over to them and then just said, oh, well, you know, what's the matter? And then they explained her story. They had adopted her. I don't know where she was from, but they just told me a war-torn country, and that she had just had like prosthetic legs fitted. And she wanted to use a tube, but she kind of felt panicked by the escalator. And, you know, and it was kind of using distractions. So I kind of talked to the little girl, and like she didn't understand much English. And then the first song that I could think of, I said to her, look, I'll sing you a song. And I sung The Wheels on the Bus Go Round and Round. Why I sung that, I don't know. I was in the tube station. I felt a bit, you know. But and then she wanted more. So I finished singing and she demanded that I sing more. And I said, look, I will sing, and I will sing a lot better if me and you get on the escalator together. Yeah, I'm a fantastic singer. So she kind of agreed, and she, you know, she stood up, she held the handrail, and I was like just opposite her, kind of like just eye to eye. And then I sung The Wheels on the Bus Go Round and Round. Like Pavarotti, you know, customers were kind of looking and that, but it was like I could see the glee in the girl's face. And then when she got to the bottom, it was kind of like, you know, I said goodbye to him, and it was just about to get on the train, and she came running back, and she kind of threw her arms around me, and it was just, and then they left my life forever. But I mean, this so the girl would be in her mid-20s now.
Wow.
And maybe she just uses a tube all the time. And,
wow.
Yeah, and it kind of just stuck with me. And just, you know, like kindness and distraction. And, yeah, it's yeah, so it's one of my favourite memories of working
it's
on
a beautiful
the underground.
Story. And it's that, it's just the power of human connection.
Yeah,
that
yeah.
It's so obvious to sort of talk about. But I do think in this day and age, we don't give it anywhere near enough attention, thought. And you guys are just cultivating that and changing the culture of the tube due to your own work, but also the boards and just getting people to connect. It's just so powerful that, you know, you could have, like you say, changed that girl's experience of the tube forever.
Absolutely.
Through
absolutely.
Seeing someone and getting it and being there. And it's just, and kindness.
Yeah.
Kindness seems so absent sometimes.
Yeah.
And again, I think what you guys do is just highlighting kindness, like simple kindness. Be nice to each other. It's
yeah,
so important.
And you know what, if people are nice to each other, it certainly makes our job easier, because
yeah, of course.
I mean, like, you got assaulted recently. Yeah. Physically assaulted.
Oh god,
like,
that's
I got
awful.
Like, you know, I was so looking forward to it. It was Paul McCartney playing at the O2, and like, we was working together, and it was crowded downstairs for everyone's safety. We had to hold people outside. But some of the people didn't like being held outside for their safety. And then someone headbutted me from behind.
Oh, my God.
And kind
God.
Of ran away. And it was like, you know,
what?
I mean, the Beatles are my favourite band ever. It's like, okay, Paul McCartney. And
I went into dad mode there.
Yeah.
All
yeah,
the
went
other
into
ones
dad
were
mode,
part of
yeah.
this troop. I was like, right. You're in trouble. You're in trouble.
Yes, Jeremy. I love it.
I was like, because I saw it straight on. I was like, what's he doing? He ran off as well. So I thought, no, this is a bit childish. But I mean, you know, we've both, you know, been assaulted on a job. Many of our colleagues have. It is unfortunate. It happens. But yeah, kindness, like you say, makes our job easier.
Yeah.
But also, it's one of the things that's kind of key to what we do. You know, be kind to each to other people. Love yourself. And know that you're not alone. These kind of like three things that we always try and infuse in everything that we do. And, you know, I think if everyone did that in life anyway, things like that wouldn't happen. You know, like, genuinely, we're closing the station in that moment to keep them from getting hurt and everyone else from getting hurt. I mean, it's insane when it's that busy. If you have to close, it's
I
really
can't
busy.
Imagine controlling that many people.
Yeah,
it's making
you know,
me stressed.
There's literally just like four of us to control 20,000 people. And it's like, this is what we got to do. But, yeah, it was unfortunate.
Because,
like you said, he's a massive Beatles fan. And it was Paul McCartney, and it's like, you've got the vibe going on.
I still love Paul McCartney.
Still,
no, you know what I mean?
Yeah,
it's not his fault.
Macca
has no part in this whatsoever.
It's just unfortunate.
But yeah, it is. And how does your social anxiety manifest in a job where you're with, at times, 20,000 people? How do you navigate that?
You know what? I've always wondered this, like, how I'm doing that job.
Yeah.
Because I remember the first week that I started, and they do this training thing where they take a group of you around station. The first station they took me to was Victoria Station, and it was like during the peak, and I was like, this is mental, I can't do this. But I was the only one who was in my head saying, I can't do this. And I was walking with them, I was like, no, I've got to do this. I've got a newborn baby, I've got, you know, bills to pay, all these kind of things. I've got to do this. And then I did it, and I kind of like, because I got through it. It's that whole mantra of, you know, you've got through all your worst days before, so you'll get through this one. And it's always in my head that I'm going to get through this. I've worked all over the network. We've both worked at over 120 stations between us, because we work all over the network. And yet, when I go to a different station each time, I've still got that feeling in me like, oh, no, I haven't been there in a while. It's going to be all, you know. And then you just get your breathing controlled, you know. You visualise the good side of things, and then you have to just turn up, and then it turns out okay. Everything goes all right, you know. Everything you think is gonna go bad doesn't actually happen.
Yeah.
And I mean, I used to be a filmmaker once upon a time before I came to the underground, and crazy imaginations was my thing. And I think that was kind of working against me when I first came to the underground. Like, oh, what if James Bond comes sliding down there and he's, you know, getting chased by machine gun people?
We can only hope.
You know, wow. None of that stuff happens. None of it happens. I mean, you know, we worked in the stations where they filmed it, but that's about it, you know.
It's very much how my brain works. Like, I'm nodding along going, oh, God, because if I feel a bit vulnerable or nervous, my overactive imagination, which serves me brilliantly if I'm, like, writing or doing a creative project, is my worst enemy, because I think of the most ridiculous, catastrophic outcome. And like you say, it rarely, like probably never has happened in that way. But you end up having to sort of retrain your brain to go, nope, and pull it back from that place. And it's really brilliant that you're I guess, sort of facing your fear daily. You know, that is, it's quite a head-on facing your fear every day.
Well, I mean, because what you're saying there is absolutely true. That's what I do.
Yeah.
But then I had, like Ian said, I got sorted recently. It was like early on in the year, just as we're trying to finish this book of all times. Got sorted at work and had to go off. And I had this kind of really bad moment where basically I had been kind of making warnings about the potential for that exact scenario happening in advance. And then it happened to me and I was like, wait, all this kind of me telling myself that none of those things are ever going to happen has just happened.
Mm.
And I was going through this through my head all the time. And we're trying to finish the book. We've got deadlines. And I was like, there must be something I can do to get out of this. So we kind of like, between us, kind of just channeled things into the book. So there's parts of the book that, you know, are kind of about that as well. You know, getting through even when you've got a resistance to things that you've created with your own mantras and so on and so forth. And then that gets broken down.
Yeah.
How you then come back from that. You know, so yeah, we tried to cover so many things in this book. It's like the first book was great, but this one here, we thought, you know, we're never going to make another book again. Let's throw it all in. Let's throw it on because there's going to be people who are going to go through all kinds of things and are going through all kinds of things. Let's see if we can, you know, figure it all out.
Yeah.
And put it all in there. So, you know.
Yeah, it's brilliant. I think, you know, it's, again, important to sort of talk about that, you know, your worst nightmare or the worst case scenario actually happening, and how do you pick yourself up and put your uniform back on and get back to work and do your job. And I guess you, like most things, you have to keep it in the day. Just today is a new day and we'll get to the end of the day and see how it is. And you can't really project that far ahead or wonder if it's going to happen again or whatever, because you drive yourself absolutely mad. And it's just a daily thing, isn't it, I guess, with anxiety.
You know. I mean, like, you change your whole life. You change your whole... You create a happy place out of it. So that's what we do. We try and channel those things and find something good that can come from it, you know, whether it's good for us or good for other people. But generally, we write just because it helps our anxieties, it helps our mental health, it helps, you know, get our minds in the right way. And it seems to resonate with people and help them out as well. So
it's a beautiful silver lining to all the shit stuff that you got to go through mentally and physically. And it's helping so many other people.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
And another thing that you cover in the book is PTSD, which, Ian, you've talked about having been a train driver and had a devastating scenario occur where somebody jumped in front of a train, which is obviously sadly prevalent in that line of work. And it's something that you've had to address in this new line of work, being in the same environment but in a different job. How has your PTSD manifested and how do you cope with it?
Do you know what? So, again, the time that it happened, so it was January 2008 and it was I was driving on the Victoria Line. And then, like, literally it was a Sunday night, wasn't busy at all. And funny enough, I wasn't supposed to be working that shift. I'd come in a day early and they said, oh, why are you here? You might as well do a shift sort of thing. I've got my days off mixed up. And then, yeah, just coming into Pimlico, I could see the platform. And there was no one on the platform. And then just out of nowhere, this like young girl just jumped in front of the train. And it was weird. It was like, it just felt like I'd seen an alien or a ghost. You know, it's like I reacted fast enough, but it was something that you kind of know might happen, but you don't expect to see. And it was like, I was trying to look away. And then just right at the last second, our eyes met and she smiled. And then it kind of stuck with me for years and years. And then, like, I was scared of the dark. So, obviously, like, my post-traumatic stress sort of came from that. I had anxiety attacks as a teenager and they kind of went away. And then they just sort of came back more so. And it's just any time that I would hear, you know, stories of a one under, certain sounds, you know, it just, I remember I'd be in the front of a car. I don't drive myself, but any time that I was in a passenger seat, you know, if someone, do you know what I mean? I was scared to be in a passenger seat and like people walking along the pavement, just kind of looking at them just in case they jumped out and stuff. And I did go back to driving trains for a while, but like you were saying, with anxiety attacks, you know, no one knows that you're actually having them. And I was having anxiety attacks with 800 people on the back of my train in the darkness of a tunnel, just believing that I was going to die. And then I was kind of like you said, worst case scenarios, you kind of jump steps ahead. So I was at the front of a train with 800 people on the back during a peak, and then thinking, is someone going to jump out at the next station? Am I going to die? Am I going to die in this tunnel? Are there going to be people stuck on the back of the train? And then I jump ahead. It's like, so if I die, I'm going to ruin my family's life. My wife's going to be homeless. Won't be able to do this. Will anyone turn up at my funeral? I'm not that popular. And it's like, my God, what's happening? You know, and it's kind of like, so again, using like creativity as distraction, you know, just writing poems, writing stories, just anything, you know, just creating your own little world of just like, you know, that you can take yourself, you know. But subsequently, I mean, this happened quite recently, didn't it? Yeah, it's so I believe that the girl had died, and she got in touch with us, which was, so Jeremy warned me. He said, look, this girl was sent an email. So I, like, literally, so I've gone through 10 years of my life sort of like just like living with guilt, anger, you know, like my train driver career was over and stuff. And then she sent us an email, didn't she? And Jeremy just said, look, don't read the email. And I said, mate, I can't, you know, because I remember at the time during counselling, I was just under the impression that she was dead. And, you know, it's just, you know, I just felt all these emotions. And then I felt more emotions finding out that she had lived, because I felt like a fraud. And I kind of felt like I'd gone through all these emotions for what, you know, all these feelings. I'd, you know, because at the time I was going mad. I was literally, my mental health was going mad. And then people were saying, look, if you leave trains behind, you earn all this money, you'd be mad to leave all this money behind. And it was like, I would choose my mental health over money any old day. Yeah. And it was kind of like, so it was just all over the place. And then when I found out that, it's like, you know, I remember during counselling, I remember a counsellor saying to me, in theory, if you could meet this girl, you'd be in the same room, what would you do with her? Like, this before I found out. And I honestly couldn't say whether I'd hug her or whether I'd hit her. And that's me being honest. And so, do you know what I mean? I forgive what she's done, but I can never forget it, because it took so long to forgive myself for the things that I was going through, you know? But yeah, still, I'm a sort of very jumpy person at situations, but it's got better, you know, because there was times when, like, literally when I was going through it, I'd be walking along a tube platform, and then, you know, when you get these intrusive thoughts, yeah?
Yeah.
And I would never do anything to myself, but I'd get these intrusive thoughts saying, oh, you know, you had someone jump in front of your train. Why don't you jump in front of a train? And I'm like, where's that voice coming from? And then it was kind of like being scared of this sort of voice. But then, like, over time, I realized, no, hold on, this is my brain, and this voice is mine, you know? So it was kind of like just telling it to shut up, quiet down, you know, jump on board, like, get creative with me, or you know, just go away. So,
yeah.
Yeah, just, but yeah, anxiety attacks, PTSD.
Yeah.
We just thought, you know, we're right about that. Someone out there may not have had similar circumstance, but maybe going through something similar. And just to tell people, you know, you're not alone. And, you know, just there is, you know, and anyone that feels like ending it all, there is always another way. There's always going to be a better day, a brighter day. Just hold on, you know what I mean? There is help out there. There are people that you can talk to, as lonely as you feel, you know?
Yeah, because it is, I think, with all of that going on with PTSD,
it's
such a lonely place.
And
I think intrusive thoughts are, like, one of the worst. I certainly had that with my PTSD and trying to make sense of things that had happened in my life. And you don't want to tell anyone because you feel like you're going mad, like you said.
Mm.
You feel embarrassed. I felt a lot of shame. And I haven't had them for a while, but if I find myself getting near anxiety or there being something that's quite triggering, but I had it so acutely at one point where I thought, and you're trying to sort of like, it's so hard to explain. I was trying to sort of physically get, mine was quite imagery led. I was like trying to get it out of my head. I didn't know how, like physically shaking my head or like, how do I get it out?
Yeah.
And I think actually the way is sort of admitting it, because then especially if someone else understands it or is even willing to listen.
Yeah.
And you go, oh, this isn't such a ridiculously freakish or unusual thing to happen. It's unbelievably common.
Yeah.
You know, all of these things that we're talking about, anxiety attacks, social anxiety, intrusive thoughts, whether it manifests as OCD, whatever it is, it's unbelievably common, but we're led to think it's not because the conversation still isn't, we're all trying to do our bit and get it out there, but it, there's still a long way to go to have these conversations totally normalised, where we could talk to our next door neighbour, the person that works in the coffee shop, whatever, and have that level of humanness and talk about it. So I think it's just so brilliant what you guys are doing
and
on this
level.
And
you know what, like you said, like it's so good to talk, you know what I mean? It's just talk about what you're going through. Because I got to the point where I was talking, and then in the end it was like, oh, I'm boring myself, you know, I don't even want to talk about it anymore, you know, and I just felt in a better place and like, let's crack on with it, you know. And like, you know, it's just, talking to one another. If you're going to ask someone how they are, and they say, I'm all right, just ask them a second time, you know what I mean? Just like, if you're taking the time out to ask how they are, just take the time to listen, you know? Just, you know, because the second answer might be very different to, I'm doing all right, you know? Mustn't grumble and all that, you know?
Yeah, and especially, I guess, with people you don't know, like with your job, but also people using the tube. Again, in this day and age, we're sort of freaked out when someone starts talking to us, probably more so in London. I know whenever I go and stay, like, I'm in love with Dorset. And whenever I go there, people, you know, it's the cliche. People are more willing to go morning or whatever if you're just walking down the street or you get chatting to someone with more ease. Whereas in London, it's head down, phone out. I'm in a rush. I'm serious. I'm not talking to anyone. And people were sort of unnerved if you did say sort of, are you okay? Like if someone looked distressed, are you okay? What is the reaction if you've approached someone to check if they're all right? Are people sort of unnerved by it normally?
Well, I like talking about what is another somber kind of story here. I was only about a year into the job at the time, King's Cross Station. It was completely rammed. There was just me and one other member of staff. And you know what? I think we learn this on the job. Amongst crowds, we start to sense things that happen because you're seeing people all the time go in like flocks and go out as flocks, and then you see someone individually in there that doesn't quite seem right. And there was a lady who was just doing almost like circles in there, and I just went over to her and said, are you okay? And then she was like, yeah, but she wasn't really looking at me. She was kind of like looking around, like, you know, planning something. So I said to her, stopped to her again, and I kind of looked straight in her eyes, are you okay, for the second time, as you say. And then she just stopped, looked at me and stared at me and said, no, actually I'm not. And then I was like, okay, can I help, you know? And to cut a long story short, you know, 45 minutes later, I was still with her. She had been planning, you know, to suicide, basically, and looking at how she could do it. And it was like, I couldn't believe it. After 45 minutes, I had, you know, spoken to this lady. The police came along. She wouldn't let go of me at that point. Now, she was holding on to my arm, having told me all about how her family had disowned her and she had no one and she didn't trust anyone and so on and so forth. And somehow I'd created this kind of bond with her. And I mean, as far as I know, you know, she went to, they took her away to get help and so on. And, and hopefully, you know, she ended up in a better place than she was certainly going to end up that day. But like you say, you've got to be willing to kind of break through.
Yeah.
I think if we're all willing to break through, the other person's going to kind of recognize that. If it's just like a fleeting, like, you are, you know, not really fussed, we can tell when someone's not really bothered about the question they're asking us, you know. So I feel like, you know, if you care about other people, you're going to ask the question the right way at the right time and good things will happen, you know, so.
Yeah, it's so true. It just takes that bit more effort, bit of courage, because it's quite a nerve-wracking thing as the person approaching that stranger to check if they're okay. You know, you have to kind of get some steel confidence yourself to approach them. But I mean, that's unbelievably worthwhile. You're saving a life by doing it. And it's
same station, like about a week or two later, I had another situation exactly the same on another part of the station as well. And I was just like, gosh, this can't be the job for the next, you know, 20 years of my life, right? Like, this is like a few weeks in a row, the same kind of thing happening. What's going on, you know? I think that kind of helped fuel when we're doing things. Like, it gives us fuel, like, oh, you know what? We can't always be there. We're just individuals. What can we do to kind of, like, get other people to be willing to do the same?
Yeah, amplify what you're doing.
Yeah, you know, because there's a lot of people walking past. They're not noticing that individual. How did they not notice that? But like I say, we notice it because we work every day with incredible crowds and we just sense, you know. I think to a lot of people, they look at staff on the underground and think, they're not doing anything. They're just, like, lounging around that. But we have a peripheral that we learn on this job of what is right and what is not right as it's happening. And we just pick things up.
I mean, your job is extraordinary. There aren't many jobs like it where the expectation is to be there for the very sort of practical, everyday stuff, but also for the deeply emotional, life-changing, impactful moments of everyday life. You know, it's a lot for you both to take that role on.
Yeah, and it's become more like, you know, Jeremy, like having those things go on, and like the messages that we've received over the years. It's like, well, like we was counting them up, and like we've received like over 1,000 messages, like direct messages from people all over the world, just saying, "Oh, you posted this at the right time. I was about to do this," or, you know, "You've changed my life for the better," and stuff. And like, you know, some people ask us for advice, and we're like, look, again, we're not medical. Like, it would be irresponsible for us, you know. It's just, but just reminding people that they're not alone, and, you know, there is help, you know. It's, yeah, it's, so that has been humbling, you know what I mean? It's like what we don't do on stations, we do on our social media, you know, and it's, and just to use social media for the good, you know what I mean? It's like, we can use it for the good, you know.
We can. Yeah. I think, you know, because we've talked about this in lots of ways on the podcast, I guess, that social media can get a lot of flack, or, you know, people point fingers at it being a terrible thing or whatever. But it's kind of a benign entity in itself. It's how we choose to use it. Exactly. And you guys have chosen to absolutely use it for the very best possible methods, and to reach as many people as you can, and to celebrate brilliant things, but really draw our eye to important causes too. And you can use it to like properly connect with people. You really can.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's a beautiful thing. And also, Jeremy, you've been very honest about insomnia, which again, I'm a kindred spirit with you on this one, my love. Again, I slept terribly last night. I got into bed way later than I would like to normally. I took some melatonin. That took the edge off a bit, but I still didn't go into a proper sleep. And again, it's a very lonely place in the middle of the night when it's dark and you've got no one to talk to, and you're just lying there. It's horrific. When did yours start? How do you deal with it?
You know, I can't even... It's been so long, I think I almost feel like I've always had insomnia. Mm. I'm sure I haven't, but then, you know, you hear stories from your mum saying you used to get up in the middle of the night and do this and do that. So it might be, maybe it's kind of always been bubbling there or something. But I think it became worse, I don't know how many years ago it was, when I got tinnitus, when I started to realise, oh, I might have tinnitus. And what happens with that is, and I notice it when I'm particularly exhausted, the tinnitus gets louder, and then you're trying to combat the tinnitus with your mind, because you've got to, because it's the only weapon you've got. And then, of course, your mind is working now more. So when your mind is working more, you're not just going into sleep. You know, I like to be like one of those people who can just pretend to sleep and then fall asleep. But, you know,
doesn't work like that always, does it?
Doesn't work.
So, you know, I stick headphones in and pop some music on, you know, some soothing kind of music that I listen to, or sounds, you know, waves or things like that. And that helps. But yeah, insomnia's crazy. I think, I mean, also when I do get sleep, I'm not really getting that REM sleep that I probably should be getting. So I'll be like, I got a whole 8 hours last night and I feel like I was up all night.
Yeah, that was me last night. That I didn't go into that deep bit.
Yeah, I think I had that last night because I woke up this morning and I tried to sleep on the train here. Luckily, I knew it was one that's going to, you know, be a long trip, so I thought, you know, I can sleep.
Have a little nap.
Why not do it? But I can't sleep on trains.
No, nor can I.
Coaches or anything like that.
No, planes. Same.
Just doesn't work.
Or in the day. Like, I can't even nap anymore. No, I used to be so good at it in my 20s. I could sleep anywhere and I could have a nap anywhere and I could sleep with any noise going on. And now it's like, has to be my bed with my pillow and my eye mask and my earplugs and the fan on, so it's a little distracting noise, and it has to be all the same, otherwise I'm screwed. Yeah. It's mad.
I use a fan as well.
Yeah.
I use a fan big time. Yeah. I hate
just that nice light hum in the corner.
Yeah. It's just sort of like the kind of white noise. And
I live on a bus route, so otherwise at 5:40 on the nose, I will hear, and I'm like, oh no. So I have to have that on to distract me from that. And I'm also on the Heathrow flight path, so that's also quite fun. Okay. Again, the first plate. I know all the timings of what flight and what bus. So the fan just takes the edge off all that and just gives me a little bit more distraction, I guess, to stay asleep sometimes. Yeah. But again, it's a shitty one, insomnia. And loads of people have got it. Millions of people are dealing with that.
I'm pretty sure if I lived in Spain, I'd be the only one awake during the siesta, because that's how bad it is. The whole country would be having a nap and coming back, being all strong, and I'd be like, no. Yeah. Ain't working.
I'm exactly the same. You know? It's mad.
But I mean, it does help to a degree. I mean, we both work lates only on the underground. That's the way our shift pattern works. So it kind of helps that when it gets really busy for us on the late part, when event people are coming out, 20,000 people coming out of the O2 at, like, you know, 11 o'clock at night. I'm just waking up. I don't know about you, but I'm just waking up. I'm like, yeah, this is all right. I can get through this. The early part of the shift, I'm like, oh, I should be in bed already. What's going on? This ain't right. But that part there, I'm like, yeah, I'm up for this. Yeah, let's do this. Let's do that. And then I get home and I'm like, yeah, now I need to go to sleep. No, let's keep going.
Yeah, because you're all buzzed up.
Yeah, I just keep going. I was like, oh, what am I going to do? Okay, let's start writing some stuff.
I feel quite bad saying this. I have no trouble sleeping at all.
But some people just don't. Loads of my friends just can. And my husband, he's just like, night. And he's gone. And it irritates me. Like, totally, yeah. Don't fall asleep so quickly, because now I feel even more of a moron that you're asleep so quickly and I'm completely not asleep.
Yeah, I do need things going around me, like happening to sleep, you know, like whether it be a podcast, like to fall asleep to, or the, you know, the fan going off and that. And I've noticed as I've become like more mature or older, I go to the toilet a lot more in the night. So generally wake up to go to the toilet. But yeah, no, I'm good with sleeping, yeah.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, it's good that you can support each other in very different
ways.
Yeah,
yeah. When I've got insomnia,
I'll send him messages in the middle of the night saying, you're awake, here's an idea, let's do this.
And I'll quickly read it on the way to the toilet and go back to sleep.
That's ideal.
Yeah, it's all good.
It's so good. When you're putting either this book out or you're writing your boards, what is your hope with any particular message?
They'll make a difference, I think. You know, it certainly helps us writing it in the first place, or putting it out there in the first place. It's like it's got us through something. So we're thinking, if it's got us through something, it's going to have to resonate with other people, surely. At least one person out there. And we've written some boards before that just tanked on social media. It's like, well, no one liked that at all. And then you get a DM from someone that said, that literally saved my life right now. And you're like,
It's not about the quantity, is it, of people? It's the individual impact.
And
like, as time has gone on, like, again, with the social media, it's like, we don't care how many likes we get, you know, because if it's liked by the right person, then you've saved a life, you know?
Yeah.
Or you've changed a life. So we're not bothered about likes anymore, you know? We just sort of go with what we feel is right at the time and then just put it out there, you know?
You wrote a poem in this new book called Happy Places.
Yes.
What are your happy places?
Well, that was inspired by your good self. Yeah. So, right. Do you want to go with your happy places? Because you've got some strange ones, haven't you? I don't know if they're totally legal, but
I hope so.
You know what? We have all kinds of discussions that go very extreme to very somber.
Do you know what? I'll kick off, yeah, because I've got one in my head straight away.
Cinema straight, because they're both of them.
Yeah, yeah. I'm going to pick cinema.
Cinema's a massive one.
Because, you know, you go cinema and you're in another world. You don't have to think about, you know, life going on outside, you know, especially like if you go to a matinee and stuff like that, you put your phone away, you're not looking at social media, you're not, your screen time is not being added up, and you can just lose yourself in a movie. I will see anything at the cinema, you know, it could be the worst film ever or the best film ever, and just I'm lost, I'm invested in this life going on. I can forget about, you know, cost of living crisis and bloody this and that, and just be lost in it, and then come out and think, okay, I'll carry on with my life now.
Yeah.
Cinema is a happy place.
It's a good sort of break, isn't it? A little breather.
Oh, totally. And do you know what? Can I talk about what I saw the other day? I'm still not over it, yeah?
Right.
Matilda. Oh, my God.
Oh, I need to see the new one.
Yeah, Matilda the musical, yeah?
Is it brilliant?
Oh, it's fantastic. Because I've seen it up the West End,
same.
Obsessed with it, yeah? And I just loved it. Yeah, so I was singing along, tapping my feet.
We had Tim Minchin on the podcast recently. He wrote all the music for it.
Of course, yeah.
Who we love.
Absolute genius.
Genius.
He's genius.
He's so funny. Yeah, that's a good one. Cinema's a good one. What about you, Jeremy?
I'm going to say Canberra Sands.
Oh, nice.
Particularly because me and my family, we go there like now almost every year we found it as the place that we go for our summer holidays. Beach is huge. You know, there's things for the kids to dig up. You know, it's so big that they can't run away anywhere fast enough that you can't catch up with them. You know? So you can actually lie back and be like, I'm relaxed. They're running away. No, they're not far enough yet. No, now they're far enough. You go running after them like that. You've got water. You've got everything, you know. And it's not one of those beaches that's got like loads of, you know, a pier and loads of lights and noise and all that. It's just kind of secluded, but not. And it's just lovely. It's got dunes as well, and just love it. But beaches in general, but I just have a thing for waves, you know, not like massive waves. I'm not about that, but like that just the right level of waves.
I'm saying,
I love
it.
You get the sound. Heaven. You've got the crashing against the sand, but then also as it goes out and the noise of nature, you know, from the birds, the seagulls, as mad as they are. I try not to eat anything that they're going to want to eat as well.
Oh, they're brutal. Yeah.
But... yeah, all of that. Love it. But the kids, it's just amazing. Beaches are amazing places for kids.
Like, would if I gave one of my happy places a plug, they might give me a discount or a free holiday. Is that okay for them? Yeah.
Give it a try.
A little bit cheeky, yeah.
I mean, let's throw the rule book out the window. Give it a try. Do you want to blag a trip to?
Yeah, so one of my favourite happy places, if you're listening, is a place called Sunset Beach Club Hotel.
Right.
And it's in Benalmadena. And it's
very specific.
Yes, and it is the sunrises there are magnificent. The staff there are fantastic. I'd love a free holiday off you. Everything's great there. They've got a kids club and all sorts. But
Should we sort of throw in Jamaica? I'll Barbados. Got any?
Maldives.
Yeah, let's throw that in there.
That's a lovely
resort, we will happily take a freebie. Let's just get what we can out of this episode.
Just get in there, Sunset Beach Club Hotel, Benalmadena, if you're offering free holidays. Fern Cotton, all on the board and that, yeah. We're right paying for you as well, yeah.
Are we going all together then?
Why not?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And then I'll do a plug,
because my missus will tell me off. Right. Home is my happy place. Just going home. Because you know what?
That's mine.
We work sometimes all over the network, and I've had to walk 2.5 hours to get home, and I'm like, I can't walk. I've just done 8 hour shift. Can't walk. But then like you start visualizing home. You know, my kids sleeping, her at home as well, the dog. He always like jumps up on me when I come in through the door. And I just start visualizing that. I'm like, yeah, I can't wait to get home. Get home. Get completely exhausted when I get home, and then stay up for 5 hours with insomnia. But
at least you're home.
But I'm home. That's it.
I'm home.
I'm going to get it. I'll get it in the ear if I don't say home as well.
Yeah, you better say
home. Yeah, so at home with the wife in her arms is my happiest place.
You've over-egged it now.
Yeah, yeah.
You've gone too far.
I'm just where the heart is and all that. Yeah.
So
anywhere with her is a home.
Oh, you're such a romantic.
Thank you very much.
I love it. No, I'm the same. Home is, hence my work from home a lot. I just... I just love being at home. And with Simon the cat, you've already met. But look, I think what you're doing is fantastic, as you know. And I hope that you'll come back to the festival and do more next year.
If we're invited.
Of course you're invited. Right, you can come every year.
Oh, fantastic.
And I love this book, Your Daily Companion. Everyone needs to have this just on their bedside or... just somewhere they can pick it up and pick any random page a day and read little excerpts.
In the toilet as well.
In the toilet is a great place.
We got told by a lady that a little while back.
Perfect lubricant.
She goes, I've got your book in the toilet. And then she goes, I hope I don't offend you, but I've got your book in my toilet. And it's like, no, we're not offended. You know? And it's like, does it help you go? Oh, it really helps me go.
Keeps it regular.
We're just going to put that on the front of the book. It helps you go. You know, selling points.
So, I'm glad that you didn't because it's perfect as it is. We like inspiring words to take from morning to night.
That will do.
Ian and Jeremy, thank you so much for being on Happy Place. It's been an absolute joy.
Thanks for having us.
You're just amazing. Thank you so much.
Oh, Jeremy and Ian, thank you so much. I cannot tell you how much gorgeous energy they brought to my little studio at the end of my garden. I was buzzing for ages after they left. Such lovely people. All on the Board, Your Daily Companion is out now. And wherever you choose to read it, it will absolutely lift your spirits with all the never-before-seen boards and poems and personal stories from the guys. Someone else, by the way, who had similar advice to Ian about making sure you ask people twice how they really are, was Roman Kemp. If you did miss that episode, do scroll back in your feed and have a listen, because that was another particularly moving episode. Thank you so, so much again to Ian and Jeremy, to the producer, Anushka Tate at Rethink Audio, and to you. Make sure you look up from your phone next time you're on a train. I bet you'll feel better for it. Loads of love. I'll speak to you soon.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.